It's the 2nd of June 2006. My name's Lynn Fox, and I'm here with Mr. Raymond Hodges, who's going to talk to us about Thorn and Hatfield Moors. Morning, Mr. Hodges.
Good morning.
I wonder, first of all, if you could, would mind telling me where you were born?
I was born in South Wales in 1935. And the reason we came to this part of Yorkshire is that my father came up from the Welsh mines to the Yorkshire mines, obviously finding work, and Thorn Collieries then had just started to open up. That was in 1937 when the colliery became active. And obviously there was different people from different parts of the country, Durham, Geordies, Scotch, Welsh, and obviously they came to the new mine, which was Thorn Collieries.
And where did you live then? You
we first came and we first lived in Thorn. The reason we lived in Thorn to begin with was because that was the only accommodation that my parents could get at the time, because they were still building moor ends then. And what we call the pit houses was being built, in the process of being built. So my mother and father had to find private accommodation till as such times as they got a pit house. And that would be, as I say, between 37 and 39. Then my father got a job at Thorn Colliery. My granddad had came down previous to that from the Welsh mines. And that's how some of my relations came to work in the pit in Moor Ends. And that's how we came to be in Yorkshire.
So how many members of your family were actually in Moorends?
At that time, when we came from Wales to Moorends, Thorn, there was my mother and father, my elder brother, Des, my elder sister, Vera, my elder brother, Charles, and myself. And then along the way, there were 7 children of us all together.
And did you say your granddad was here as well?
Yes, my granddad and grandmother was here. They came for the mine to work in the pit, and I do believe one of my father's sons, brothers came, my uncle Tom. I think he came to work in the mine. Well, I think he came with my grandmother and grandfather. So that was like the grandparents to my father in the pits, and subsequently there's been relations in the family that's worked down the mine, and also my elder brother, he worked down the pits, which is Thorn Colliery.
And did your granddad and all your other relations stay in Moor Ends? They didn't go back to
Wales? No, they didn't go back, they stayed. My grandfather in particular got a pit house, as it happens, and he stayed in Moor Ends all his life from leaving Wales, and my father and mother also. My mother came from Bristol, as a matter of fact, and my father came from South Wales, same as my grandparents, and they came here and they lived the life out in Moor Ends, and as I say, they're all buried here actually.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Thorn Secondary. Well, first of all, I went to Moor Ends Junior Infants. And then from there, from the junior school, I went to the Thorn Secondary Modern School, which is in Thorn itself. That's no longer there now. That's been pulled down, and they're rebuilding a new housing estate there. So it was Thorn Secondary Modern School.
And who were your main friends at school?
Well, obviously, my main friends was members of the school football team. I played football for the school team, and my main friends was the school team members, obviously 10 other ones, if you like. I mean, I can name most of them, but it was a school football team, and we won a few trophies, and we was a pretty good team actually in the Doncaster area. We won the Daily Dispatch Shield, and we've won numerous other things, and then I carried on being an amateur player with a local amateur team in Thorn, and that was my main interest, apart from, as I said, when I was younger, during the summer holidays from school, it was a question of making your own entertainment. my entertainment evolved mainly around the moors. It was on the doorstep. My mother and father's house was literally 100 yards from the beginning of the moors. And we used to go over there doing various things, swimming in the lake, collecting firewood, collecting rhododendrons, flowers, you name it. We were just doing natural boy things. But we obviously, with going over there, there was families living on the moors at that time. To what I can understand and what I've told by some older relatives of mine.
You were telling me when I first came, you took me along a track or something onto the moors, didn't you? You took me along a track that you used to walk on.
Yes. We could go onto the moors in two different ways. We could go down the what we call the allotments and go on the moors from the pit tip side, or we could go through the colliery and go round the colliery and go on the moors from that side. So we had two avenues of entry to the moors. If I went on the moors from the allotment side, I used to go round the tip. Now that in them days there was a track which led you around there, round the pit tip onto the moors. Or if I went on the pit side, there was a track which led a proper road that led you past the various families living on the moors. So we could go from two directions on the moors. Mm.
So how many was it like you and a few friends?
Well, in general, there was me and my brother. I was pally with the youngest son of one of the families, and my elder brother was pally with the eldest son of the family. So my elder brother used to do his thing with Ernie, that was the elder brother, and I used to do my thing with Nocky, that was his nickname, but his name was Ronald, but Nocky, and we used to do our thing on the moors. Obviously, there was other children that went over there, but they used to go over there on their own initiatives, whereas we used to go with the family, the Bells family in particular. In fact, mainly the Bells family, because although we knew the other families, the Bells was a family of children. I think there was 8, 10 in total, and obviously, with them being a family of children, we related to them more than the other families, and that was the general idea of going over there to play with the Bells family.
Did the Bells actually live there?
Yes. If you was going from the pit side, the colliery side, and you walked round the screens and through the pit yard and round the screens, you went down the lane, as we call it then, and the first dwelling you came to was the Varices. Now, the Varices was a Dutch family, and I do believe they were the elder generation of the Varices family. They was part of the draining of the area with the Dutch. Also, with the Varice dwellings, there was a German family called the Smits. Now, the Varices was a family of, I believe, there was 8 children. There was 5 boys and there was 3 girls. The Smits was a German family, and they was and I believe they was part of the draining system. And they was just a family of one, as far as I know, one daughter. And she was a local postwoman later on. Then you carried on round the lane, you passed the big lake, as we call the Pike Lake, because we were told there was pike in there, so we never swam in there. Then you came to the Bells and the Sharps. Now, this was a big rumbling dwelling with the gable ends on the roof. Now, the Sharps lived in one half of the dwelling, and the Bells lived in the other half. Now, as I said, the Bells was a very large family. Initially, I think when we was kids, there was maybe 5 children there, but subsequently they had a lot more when they came off the moors. And the Sharps, now the Sharps had, to what I can make out, 2 children, a boy and a girl. Now, as far as the recollection goes, Mr. Bell was unemployed for most of my recollection. As I say, he lived in one half of the dwelling, and Mr. Sharp and his family lived in another. Now, Mr. Sharp was employed by the colliery, And at that time it was privately owned, and that was owned by a company called Pease and Partners. Now there is, I think there is some photographs where the railway wagons have got that, the coal wagons have got that name on the side of them, Pease and Partners. And Mr. Sharp worked for those. Now he had a horse and dray, and what he was employed with was going on the local tip collecting surplus coal that hadn't been screened, and he used to collect the coal up and take it to the what they call the land sale area, which was at the outset, at the beginning of the village before you went onto the pit. And he used to collect that and give it back to the pit company, Pease and Partners, in Landsale. Now Landsale was where the own coal deliveries came from. That was the section of where all the miners got free coal, and they got coal every month or every 2 months, I'm not sure which. And then they used to sell coal to private contractors, and they used to come and collect coal, and then they would do their business and sell it privately. But Mr. Sharp used to collect the coal for the colliery, and that's that was his occupation. And as I say, he had a son and a daughter, but when I was a child they was much older than me, so I never personally played with the Sharps. We used to go over there, say, in the summer months. We used to go swimming in the lake, playing on the moors, swings, and just in general roaming the moors.
Whereabouts did you go swimming?
There was two big lakes at the side of the Sharps and Belts house. One really big lake, as I said, that was called the Pike Lake. We was told there was pikes in there, we never knew. And there was a smaller lake right in front of the Sharps and Bells house, and then it had an offcut where there was a stream that came from the lake, and that used to go across the moors, and that went right down past Bells house through the moors, and I do believe that ended up somewhere in the Crowell area, but I never knew that because I never followed it past the other family, which was on the east side, and that was the Emersons. Now they lived in a cottage down the east side of the moors, and you carried on round the pit and you went down the lane going towards Hatfield that way, which was the east side, and they was called Emersons. Now they was a family of mother, father, boy and a girl, but we used to go that end collecting rhododendrons. Also there was a big vast now, damson orchard down there. We used to go collecting damsons and all.
Did that belong to anybody?
No, it was just a wild damson orchard. It was, but we never played much down that end because of the big stream. We could never get across anyway. And we used to go so far down for the rhododendrons. Then we would come back to the village and make them in bunches and sell them to the local population or neighbours.
Was there one particular area that the rhododendrons all grew?
Oh no, they grew wherever you wanted to roam, generally, but generally outside of the streams where there was water in general. When you went further into the moors it was fern and bracken and peat bogs, but the rhododendrons was vast. But there was always where there was water, round by the lake and the stream near Bells and Sharps, and also what we call down at White City, oh, that's where the main stream went across the moors. So they tended to grow there. If you went into the moors, as I said, he was going into the moors proper then. Silver birch, mainly, that was the trees. Ferns, and as I said, bogland, that was in the moors itself. But also there was quite a few larger trees. I never knew what make there was, but there was large ones. But generally it was silver birch.
Mm. Why did you call it White City?
Because the rhododendrons in general in that particular area was white, whereas against the general run of rhododendrons would be purple, there would be a mauve colour and there would be a pink colour. But the reason we called it White City is because there was a very big a large area of rhododendrons that was white. But we could never get to those because there was the other side of the big stream. we used to get the purple, the mauve and the pink ones. We were called it White City for that reason.
Was it a deep stream then? That you
had? Oh, it was quite... It was, I would say it would be maybe 3 metres across. And I never knew how deep it was because we never went across it. But yes, it was. It came from. Actually, I do believe I couldn't swear where the actual water came from. Although they pumped a lot of water out of the mine onto the moors, plus the two lakes, and we understood there was an underground reservoir somewhere that fed these particular streams and lakes. But I do know that they pumped a lot of water out of the mine because Thorn Quarry was noted for being, it was sunk, and they ate water when they were sinking the mine, and they had to pump it off. And in general, it was in the shaft area, and that was pumped onto the moors. So that was part of where the water came from. But I was told that there was an underground stream that fed these streams and the lake, so I never knew where that actual source was, but.
And there were farms and things around there, I think you're saying.
There was, to my knowledge, on the west side was the Thorn Ghoul area. That was generally thick vegetation, thick moorlands. On the east side, it was a lot of the land, quite a bit of the land was claimed for farmland. That was to the east, in between Thorn and Atfield. Now, in general, there was one farmer which farmed that land, and that was Birtwistle. And when I was a young boy, the father was Harry Birtwistle, and he had a son and two sons and a daughter, and he claimed part of the edge of the moors. And he used to farm that, and in fact, it's still farmed to this day.
What kind of things did he grow?
Oh, modern crops: wheat, peas, pulses, potatoes, in general. And also, he was a dairy farmer, and he was a mixture of both. In fact, Harry Birtwistle was the farmer in the area in general. I mean, he had a rather large farm, and I went to school with his son John, and occasionally I played on the farm, but very rarely, because Harry was a bit of a strict father, and he had to mind your P's and Q's and watch what he was doing. But yes, he farmed to the east side of the moors, on the edge, just adjacent to what we call White City and the Emersons' dwelling, and that was that part of the moors. But as I say, we used to go over there, and when it was when there was harvesting the crops, and in them days, they didn't have these mechanisms, and they used to do it manually, and they used to have wigwams of poles, 8-foot poles, which they got off the moors naturally, and they used to put the stacks, wigwams, and then they used to put the peas to dry out, the beans to dry out, and so on. But we used to go and occasionally take a wigwam apart and have the poles for leaping the dikes over there, and where we couldn't get across, where there was water, we'd leap across on these poles. So Harry wasn't too pleased with us if ever he saw us doing that. Harry used to make sure we knew he was there, and that was another part of growing up on the moors. And as I say, that was the families, the Varices, the Smiths, the Bells, the Sharps and the Emersons, and they was the people who lived on the moors.
So when you're getting up to mischief on Mr. Birtwistle's farm, was it just you and Nocky, or was it...
Oh, no, this was... No, Nocky... Occasionally Nocky used to come with us, but in general it was the kids out of the village. I mean, once they latched onto the fact that there was leaping poles about, and we would go down the dikes, and we'd be leaping the dikes. Of course, it caught on, and then you'd get some of the other children going across and taking poles. But in general, it was the village children that was taking the poles mainly. I've been across with Nocky and that, but generally it was the village kids. And that was that part of growing up on the moors.
And they said you met swings and things like that.
Oh, yes. I mean, we'd get old ropes off the tip and belting and make swings with, make seats out of the belting. Belting is what they used to bring the coal along the pit bottoms and we used to cut pieces up and make a seat for the swings. We used to swing across the streams. You name it, we used to do it. I mean, in general, we used to just roam the moors, just getting up to whatever took his fancy. In the winter, we used to go to the tip, come down the tip on bits of old belting, bits of sheeting, sliding down snow, obviously, and ice, sliding down the tip. Also, over there, funnily enough, in between the tip and the east side, Emerson's, the Home Guard used to practice rifle shooting over there. And there was a rifle range, and they used to play on the actual contraption that went up and down with the targets on. And they used to go across the field facing the tip, so where the targets was in front of the tip. So when they aimed at the targets, the bullets was actually going into the tip itself, as against being, you know, random. And we used to go and the actual target area was a contraption where they put a target on one contraption and then a target on another contraption, and they pulled one down and the other one went up. Now, when that target had been aimed at, they used to lower that one and the other one used to go up. Then they would replace or stick tape on where the bullet holes were on that one, and then it'd be going up and down. And then they'd shoot from across the field towards the tip area. And that was another. We never went to. They used to fly a red flag whenever the Home Guard was practicing rifle shooting. Obviously, we could never go across the moors then, because there was people stopping you from going on either side of the moors. But that was another episode. We used to go as near as we could, just to listen to the guns being fired, and then we used to go on the tip to try and find used bullet heads. You know, we used to find a few, but if you found one, it was a real find. And I mean, being small kids, 8 or 9 year olds, and if you found a bullet embedded in the tip, it was a good find actually.
What did you do with them then?
Well, we used to keep them as souvenirs. I mean, to find a bullet at that time, especially when the war was on, I mean, it was like a wartime souvenir. We used to keep them, put them in a tin or in a box or whatever. And that was another part of playing on the moors.
So the Home Guard used to practice rifle shooting?
Oh, yeah.
This was Thorn Home Guard.
Yeah, well, it was the local Home Guards. Well, I'm saying local. I mean, I don't know whether they came out of the area in general. It was done with live ammunition, and it was the Home Guards that I think every so often they gave them live ammunition for target practice. I think they may have had two rifles between one squadron. I don't know, but I know they, as I said, they used live ammunition because we used to pick the bullets up occasionally. If there wasn't embedded too far in the tip.
Now, the moor was used for other things in the war as well, wasn't it?
There was an airfield on the moors. There was two airfields. One was at Lindome, and later on there was Finningley. Now, Lindome, as when I was a child, was the main aerodrome. Now, that was on the edge of the moors, but that was on the outfield side of the moors. Lindome is between Thorn and Bawtry, and Finningley also, which now is Robin Hood Airport, and Lindome is now the local jail. But Lindome was the main bomber aerodrome when I was a kid, and they used to fly from there Wellingtons and Lancaster bombers. Now, during the war, there was a plane crash in Moorends, and that was a Lancaster bomber. And that was manned by a Canadian crew, and that crashed adjacent to what is now Darlington Grove, adjacent to the railway line. And then there was just the houses on the main road of Moorends, and back of those it was open fields, then the railway line from Hull to Doncaster and Sheffield. And the plane didn't make it back to Lindome, and that crashed as I said, adjacent to Downton Grove. Now, all the crew was killed in that, and my elder brother can remember that, going, getting near to that, and the ammunition exploding. We never got as near as that because he was stopped. But my brother and a few of his friends went the long way round, and they went across the fields on the backside. And he can remember the ammunition exploding from that particular crash. When we was kids, and there was one crashed over the moors, and me and Nocky Bell, we crawled through the bracken and the fern and the silver birch trees to the one that crashed on the moors itself. But we got little bits of plain later on when there was no one about, but in general there was the RAF and police and all the service personnel was on the moors. We never did get too near to that because it was cordoned off. But that was another one. My older brother told me that there was another plane, but that made a forced landing. Now that made a forced landing what we know as the warping drain. That's a drain that comes from the River Don, and it cut through the outskirts of Moor Ends on the road to Rawcliffe, and that went across the moors up to the edge of the moors, and the farmers used to use that drain as irrigation, watering the land. Now this particular plane had to make a forced landing. I can't recall that because I think I was younger then. But my brother said he can recall it, and he watched the plane. What they did, it made a forced landing, but it didn't crash. I think it was a mechanical fault. And it landed in a field adjacent to the warping drain. And what they did then, they brought the RAF personnel out, and they serviced the plane and repaired it for whatever reason it forced landed for. And my brother said then they towed it across as far as they could to the river, facing the moors on the west east side, and then it took off across the fields. So that was one plane that they reclaimed for the war effort. But my elder brother said he can recall that plane taking off across the field. I can't. I think it was when I was younger, and I wouldn't remember that. So that was like three aeroplane incidents within the vicinity of Moor Ends as I was a child.
Do you remember them coming across? Do you remember them flying over?
Oh, yeah. We even, as a child, we even stood on our back doorstep. As I said, we was 50 yards, 100 yards from the actual moors. We were more or less the last houses on that particular site, edge of the village. And we many a night we stood on the back doorstep, and I even saw them bombing Ghoul. We could see the flashes and the fire glow when they bombed Ghoul Docks, and the planes came over. And I mean, they used to shake the house sometimes because Moor Ends, the edge of Moor Ends was, I mean, you're talking of a very short distance to Lindholm, and they came across the moors in general, depending where they came from, but in general they came across the edge of the moors. In fact, where the local airport planes are flying from now, they come across the edge of the moors, and that was the general flight path. The bombers used to vibrate the houses when they came across or come into land, and I can recall them. But we couldn't stand outside with the back door open or the lights. I mean, the ARP wardens would tell you in no uncertain terms to cover the lights up and put that light out. But I used to stand. We even had an old air raid shelter at the side of the house, for the reason of obviously, but we never ever did. Ghoul was the nearest place to get bombed, and they got quite a bit of damage, did Ghoul. So, yes, we could see the bombers going across nightly. Generally, it was night. They did a lot of night bombing from Lindholm. Occasionally, they did daylight, but in general, it was night bombing.
And did you see much of the crews and things? Did they?
The crews used to come in now and again into Thorn, but in general, they kept at the Bawtry side. And the Finningley side, obviously there was local pubs there, and in general they kept at the Finningley side of the airport aerodrome. Occasionally, yeah, we used to see Air Force personnel in town. We used to see American troops in town. This is Thorn, and they used to billet soldiers in Thorn in the church prior to moving embarkation. Yeah, we've seen American personnel there. We've seen British personnel in Thorn itself, but in general, they never came into Thorn. Only occasionally when they wanted a night out or to visit another local pub.
You said there were Canadians there.
There was a variety of crews. To what I can understand, I know obviously there was British crews. I mean that stands to reason, and there was Canadians. I'm not sure what were the nationalities. There could have been New Zealand, Australian. I mean, in general, during the war, they manned the crews to whatever personnel they could get, and a lot of Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders, even Poles, free Poles came over as air crews. I can only recall Americans, Canadians and British. Whether there was other nationalities, I don't know. But at that time, I didn't live in Thorn. I used to obviously come into Thorn, but I was, as I say, I lived in Moorends. And all we saw in Moorends was the prisoners of war working on the farmlands in the area. Now we had, I think in general, there was Italian prisoners, mainly, and they used to go about with big yellow round discs on the tunics and patches on the trousers, and they used to come and work on the land for the farms.
Was there a camp nearby, or did they bring them in?
They used to bring them in. There was a camp, what, it's a mile away from Thorn, and that camp is in between Thorn and Atfield. Now that was if I recall correctly, that was a Royal Artillery camp, and they used to billet soldiers there. In fact, it was an army camp, and I'm not sure whether the Italian prisoners of war was interned at that camp or what. I don't know, because very rarely we went past Thorn. Occasionally we used to go into Doncaster, but that was a treat, beyond a treat. The camp was there during the war, and then it became a postal camp, and at this moment in time it's the Moorlands Open Prison. It's where they rehabilitate them to go leaving the prison service, the prison itself. So that's now an open prison, and that's still there, the site's still there.